Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. Get the book that Kevin Gutzman called the single best volume on original intent ever written, My Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. It is the book. When people ask me what's my favorite, that's the one. Pick it up wherever books are sold online and get a real education on the Constitution. Debt danger ahead. That's the headline from Bloomberg, which normally isn't a gloom and doom publication. People should take notice of this. I'll talk about that on this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act local. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. All right, so Bloomberg has a new article out talking about the looming debt danger ahead. Now, this typically isn't an area that I talk about a lot on the show, so I'm going to use it as a way to discuss American history and the debt danger ahead. In fact, there's a really interesting line in it, and I'm also going to bring up an article that Ron Paul wrote to correspond to this at the Ron Paul Institute. Copied over at lewrockwell.com. But I want to focus on the first line of the Bloomberg piece. The title is A Million Simulations, One Verdict for U.S. Economy, Debt Danger Ahead. So they've run simulations on what can happen. How can we wiggle our way out of this problem? And the first line is this. The Congressional Budget Office warned in its latest projections that U.S. federal government debt is on a path from 97% of GDP last year to 116% by 2034, higher even than in World War II. The actual outlook is likely worse. So, a little historical comparison. Higher even than in World War II. So let's think about World War II. The United States gets involved in World War II in 1941. Before that point, Congress had passed something called the Lend-Lease Act, and so the United States was acting as the bank for the Allied powers. It was lending or leasing a tremendous number of equipment. The banks were financing the war effort. This is why Charles Lindbergh on September 11, 1941, makes a very famous speech in Des Moines, Iowa, where he lists a series of organizations or groups that were interested in getting America involved in World War II. And lo and behold, he's called all kinds of names for this speech. But when you actually read it, there was nothing in it that sounded too anti-Semitic at all. He points out the banking industry. He points out the war party, essentially. He points out the American Jewish interest, which would have a vested interest in the United States getting involved in World War II, considering what was happening in Poland and Germany and other places with Jewish people in those areas. So he was called all kinds of names for this, but he's just simply stating a fact. These are groups that wanted the United States involved in World War II. The banking industry, primarily because they were making a lot of money on this. The war party, because they seemed to benefit from this. And of course, Franklin Roosevelt will give a speech blasting Lindbergh and all the America First people as being anti-Semitic and other things. And Lindbergh's name is run through the mud. Now, I go through Lindbergh in my book, Forgotten Conservatives in American History with Clyde Wilson, the Lindbergh, his father and son, right? C.A. and also Charles Lindbergh, the son. And Charles Lindbergh came by this honestly. His father, C.A., was also opposed to American involvement in World War I. He was opposed to the creation of the Federal Reserve. He was opposed to all kinds of things, right? Banking and war. Same thing with Charles Lindbergh. So there wasn't any malintent on Lindbergh's part. He just simply pointed out groups that were interested in this conflagration. And again, you can understand why. And his point was the United States was better off staying out of the war. But when war came in December of 1941, Lindbergh, of course, went off, tried to join the U.S. military. He was denied, so he's a private citizen flying bombing raids over Japan, which is rather interesting. I don't know how many other people did that. But he's saying, look, we've got this real serious problem. Now, after the war is over, of course, the United States ramps up the economy during World War II. When I say they ramp it up, they nationalize everything just about. The military business takes off. This is what, you know, Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. It takes off in World War II, and it's never slowed down. It's never slowed down. We've never come off a wartime footing since 1941. That's how long the United States has been engaged in a war, since 1941. We haven't ever left it. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. When World War II was over, Truman never demobilized. He just transferred things around, moved things around. And of course, we got the Cold War, so we got to make sure that our military stays prepared to go fight the commies everywhere. And of course, that leads to the Korean War, later the Vietnam War, all the other proxy wars that Nixon tries to limit, but isn't very successful in that. I mean, somewhat. The War on Terror. Anything you can point to, we've got to keep the military-industrial complex fed, and we got to stay on a mobilized, a militarily mobilized economy. We've got over a million people just in the United States military. And only a fraction of those are actually frontline troops. So the United States military has served, in many ways, as another jobs program for American citizens. We've got a federal bureaucracy that's got over 2 million people in it. All of that really ramped up during, of course, the New Deal, and then the New Deal on steroids, which was World War II. That never shrunk. So once we get out of World War II, we just keep expanding the bureaucracy. Then you get to the war on poverty, right? The Great Society. And the Great Society expands that out even further. You get all the other efforts after the Great Society to expand the Great Society, and that means more bureaucrats and more layers of government and everything else. I mean, this creates the modern bureaucracy, and you've got a lot of people who are involved in that. I talked about that last week. So this costs a lot of money. This is Lyndon Johnson, guns and butter. You pay for guns because that keeps the conservatives happy, and you pay for butter, and that keeps the left happy. In fact, you could say that Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt, I mean, look, they're both operating under the same premise. Historically, they were the most even-handed, wasteful spenders in America. I mean, unless you count all the current administrations, which do the exact same thing. None of these administrations want to trim spending because that's politically disastrous. You can't do it. This is why when Bloomberg puts out a piece like this and says, hey, it's probably worse, people should pay attention. It's probably worse. And what Ron Paul says, which of course he's right about this, all that's going to happen is nobody's going to tackle these spending issues. No one. So the end result is going to be a tax on America. And that tax on America is going to be inflation. Now, the problem with the inflation tax is that you can't do anything about it. You can go out and get another job and try to make more money and do more things, but eventually you run out of time to do this stuff, right? I mean, you only have so much time, so you have to start cutting stuff. You are impoverished by an inflation tax, whereas if prices stayed stable, you wouldn't have that. You go out and get a job and you could actually make more money, and then you could do better for yourself. But with an inflation tax, no matter what you do, unless you can keep up with that inflation, which right now, I mean, we call good inflation 3%. You think about that logically. Unless you can make 3% more every year, you're making 3% less. This is why for years, the Democratic Party was committed to sound money. Not until you got to the end of the 19th century did you start seeing a shift in that. And of course, with the progressives, you saw it even worse. But sound money matters. And you go back to Jefferson, you go back to his first inaugural address, which should be the inaugural address that everybody reads as a real basis of American principles. It's got the foreign policy element. It's got the domestic policy element. It is perhaps and arguably the best inaugural address in the history of the United States. Jefferson's first. It's why I talk about it at McClanahan Academy in several different classes. But it's the first, and it's the best. I mean, Washington's was first. Jefferson's first. But it's the best. It's better than anything Washington did. Better than anything John Adams did. I mean, Jefferson's was the best. And everyone built on that moving forward. For the next 24 years, people are thinking about Jefferson, not Washington. It's amazing how that worked. Even Lincoln referred to Jefferson over Washington. Jefferson becomes the key. Now, Washington was the symbol. Washington's the indispensable man, the man that held the Union together, the glue, the man that everyone looked to as the symbol of America. But Jefferson, politically, was the guy. Lincoln wasn't, I mean, he's not a Jeffersonian. But he was a Henry Clay guy, and Henry Clay considered himself to be a Jeffersonian with Hamilton's economic system. You see, that's the key. So Bloomberg is saying the actual outlook is likely worse. From tax revenue to defense spending and interest rates, the CBO forecasts released earlier this year are underpinned by rosy assumptions. Plug in the market's current view on interest rates and the debt-to-GDP ratio rises to 123% in 2034. Then assume, as most in Washington do, that ex-President Donald Trump's tax cuts mainly stay in place and the burden gets even higher. With uncertainty about so many of the variables, Bloomberg Economics has run a million simulations to assess the fragility of the debt outlook. In 88% of the simulations, the results show the debt-to-GDP ratio is on an unsustainable path, defined as an increase over the next decade. And you have a chart here. By 2050, it's at 150%. 150%. And they give you some benchmarks, right? The Lehman bankruptcy in the early 2000s is one benchmark. And after that, boy, it's almost a hockey stick. And what happens here? This is the danger. So really you have a couple of choices. One is to raise taxes. That could be happening. You've already had Republicans float the idea of Social Security not even being able to, you're not be able to get that till you're 75, right? So that's the other thing, right? You make it where people just really can't get Social Security. And in a way, when you look at how Social Security was designed, it wasn't supposed to be a retirement program to let people sit on Social Security for 30 or 40 years. The original retirement age was just barely below the average lifespan in America. It was 62. People lived to 65. They got it for about 3 years and then they were gone. But with improvement in health and all these other things, people are living longer, medications and things. So now 62 or 65 gets you a decade or more. In some cases, 20 years, two decades. So Social Security has become a much longer forecasted welfare program, essentially. That's very, very expensive, and it relies on people working to pay for it. So that's the issue, right? But we've got that. You've got, okay, so higher taxes. Do we need, or should we just have, instead of people pay 7.5% for that, should we charge 25%? Quarter of your income into Social Security. Now, that's going to create a real nasty situation because everybody's got to pay Social Security. If you're working a minimum wage job or you're, you know, making very good salary, you're paying Social Security. And it's going to hit the lowest income people the hardest when you raise that Social Security tax. So you can say, well, we'll only raise it on people making this amount of money or whatever it is. But still, you're raising taxes. How much more can people be taxed? So the solution really has to come in spending cuts. And this is where Jefferson, again, in his first inaugural, said we need a wise and frugal government. We need that. We need to make sure that the government is essentially balanced. And if we have any extra revenue, we're retiring debt. In fact, when you get to the Jackson administration, which sounded a lot like Jefferson again, that's the only time in the United States, history of the United States, that we had no debt. during the Jackson administration. Now, people would look back at this and say, well, you know, Hamilton, he was a smart guy. He said debt's good. A little debt's good. Yeah, a little debt. It can get you credit, and you can use that to your advantage. But on the other hand, the kind of debt that we have now, and Alexander Hamilton wouldn't have been for that. I mean, nobody in the founding generation would be for the type of financial environment that we have in the United States today. It's just, it's preposterous to think that. The piece says, the Biden administration says its budget, featuring a slew of tax hikes on corporations and wealthy Americans, will ensure fiscal sustainability and manageable debt servicing costs. What does that even mean? Manageable. So you're going to tax corporations. What happens there? Prices go up because the corporations, which provide goods and services, are just going to charge more for everything. So what happens? Even though the corporations are paying the tax, they're going to raise prices. It creates almost an inflationary situation. So the corporations will pass it on. Wealthy Americans, now you're going to target individuals. And yeah, I mean, you can do that. But what is wealthy? Where do we cut this off? It depends on who you ask. If you ask people that don't have a lot of money and say, what's wealthy? They'll say, you know, $100,000 a year. And you probably have some people in D.C. that would go along with that. Maybe, you know, individual making $100,000 a year, they should pay more taxes. For what? For what is the question? I do believe we need to reduce deficits and to stay on a fiscally sustainable path, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told lawmakers in February. Biden administration proposals offer substantial deficit reduction that would continue to hold the level of interest expense at comfortable levels. But we need to work together to try to achieve these savings, she said. Trouble is, delivering on such a plan would require action from a Congress that's bitterly divided on partisan lines. Republicans who control the House want deep spending cuts to bring down the ballooning deficit, without specifying exactly what they'd slash. Democrats who oversee the Senate argue that spending is less of a contributor to any deterioration in debt sustainability, with interest rates and tax revenues the key factors. Neither party favors squeezing the benefits provided by major entitlement programs. Aha! There's the issue. Neither party favors squeezing the benefits provided by major entitlement programs. And these major entitlement programs could be all kinds of things. It could be, I don't know, defense contractors. Or it could be Social Security. Or it could be Medicare. Or it could be VA benefits. Or it could be welfare. It could be SNAP programs. It could be anything. It could be the amount of waste that we have for studying the reproductive habits of rats. I have no idea, but I mean, there's a lot of waste out there. It could be the billions of dollars we're sending to Ukraine. Anybody ever think about that? No, that's not a problem. It's not a problem we spend billions of dollars for foreign powers when we really don't have it. So when we think about these budgetary problems, really spending does have to get cut. But everything is political. And that brings us to the Ron Paul piece. His headline, the Senate calls out-of-control spending a national security threat. Keep spending anyway. This is true. Now, I brought up World War II. In World War II, the total financial output is estimated at around $1,000,000,000 for the war, which is around $12 trillion today. Around $12 trillion. That's what we spent, or everybody spent, on fighting World War II. What an extreme waste when you start talking about war and what it does. Now, I know you can say, well, McClanahan, we got to get rid of the totalitarians. Okay, well, we got rid of one and then propped up another and spent the next 50 years trying to get rid of that one for more trillions of dollars. I mean, this is what happens when you become an imperial power. Paul says, last month the U.S. Senate passed a resolution saying the over $34 trillion and growing national debt threatens national security. True. Because if the United States runs out of money, it can't fund anything. I mean, look, if we're looking at GDP spending of 134% just to service the debt, where are you going to pay for anything else? So to pay for anything else, you have two options. You can print more money, which is what they'll do. You can borrow it. you're in the Weimar Republic now when you have that situation. Now, I'm not a gloom and doomer, and I mean, I'm not one of these people who say, you got to run out and prep and do all this kind of stuff. I don't know what's going to happen. This is the next decade we're looking at this. And I'm sure there'll be a stopgap here and a stopgap there, and they'll try to wiggle around this here or there. Something will happen where they'll do that. I mean, even at the decline of the Roman Empire, when the denarii became worthless, I mean, it was. They took all the precious metals out of it. It's the Roman economy still functioned. It wasn't until you had all the Germanic invasions that the Roman Empire really fell apart. Is that going to happen to the United States? Much less likely because of the big oceans. But you could see the United States be forced into a situation where it has to repudiate some of its debt. It's got to cut services and things down to next to nothing because it can't afford any of it at all when it has to pay the debt. Repudiation is probably the way. However, the 14th Amendment is going to get in the way there because you've got people that say, that sounds fair and good, fine and good, McClanahan, but the problem is you can't repudiate the debt because the 14th Amendment says you can't repudiate the debt. 14th Amendment, can't repudiate the debt. That's the issue. So, I don't know where we go from here. In fact, Paul has some policy prescriptions. He says, a few days later, a bipartisan majority of the Senate voted for a $1.2 trillion spending bill. In addition to the usual increases in war and welfare spending, the bill funds gender transitioning for minors without parental consent and red flag laws, which allow law enforcement to seize an individual's firearms without due process. I mean, yeah, there's always junk, garbage, really bad stuff in these spending bills because they pass these omnibus spending bills. This is for years. Ron Paul was an advocate of earmarks because, and this is something the Confederate Constitution did, which was fantastic. It was an innovation and an improvement, and that every spending bill had to be specified. You couldn't just have an omnibus bill. You want to spend X amount of dollars for transitioning for minors? Well, that's got to be right here. We're going to spend this amount of money. And you can vote up or down on that. Guarantee you do that, you wouldn't have the naming commission. You might have. I don't know. The Republicans are stupid in that regard anyways. But you wouldn't have this. You wouldn't have a lot of these things. They probably would not vote for this stuff. It would be knocked out. But because you put it in an omnibus bill, well, it all just gets packaged in. And then the American taxpayers are on the hook for it. It's a joke. But we've got $34 trillion in debt. We don't raise enough money to cover $1.2 trillion every year. So we're going to spend $1.2 trillion even when we say it's a national security crisis, but we're going to do it anyways. Before passage of the latest spending bill, the Congressional Budget Office released a report predicting that the national debt would exceed the prior record of 106.4% of gross domestic product by 2028. Interest payments on the national debt are estimated to reach $870 billion this year, more than the government will spend on the military. The CBO estimates that unless Congress cuts spending, which is highly unlikely, by 2051, interest on the debt will exceed not just military spending, but spending on the two biggest items in the federal budget, Social Security and Medicare. So, we've got a situation by 2051, 25 years from now, where there won't be any military spending, there won't be any Social Security spending, there won't be any Medicare spending. They won't exist because there won't be any money. You can say, well, we'll just print it out. Now you're looking at, again, hyperinflation. So what are we going to do? That's the question. You do have to start planning and try to take care of this. As Eric Bohm of Reason Magazine points out, the CBO report understates how much federal spending will grow in the next several decades since it cannot predict what crisis future Congresses and presidents will exploit to ramp up federal spending. As Bohm suggests, someone projecting 30 years ago how much government would spend in the future would not have included the increase in spending due to 9/11, the subsequent creation of a Homeland Security industrial complex, the forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the housing meltdown, or the COVID lockdown. The hypothetical budget projection would also not have predicted legislation like the Medicare prescription drug benefit or Obamacare. The large and growing interest on the national debt puts pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low. Again, this is the issue, artificially driving down interest rates because the government has to borrow money. And because it has to borrow money, it's going to say, well, we'll put the interest rates down lower, so that means it's cheaper for us to borrow this money. They can do that. They can also just turn on the printing press whenever they want, print whatever money they need. We can't. Americans can't do that. We can't say, yeah, I think that I took that loan on that. You know, that's a little too high. I think we're just going to fix that. We're just going to drive it down a little bit. You're going to get less. You're just going to do that. Oh, and I'm a little short this month. I'm just going to hit the printer and print out some dollars and go take care of this problem. You can't do it. The government can't. He says, the Federal Reserve's rate increases, though relatively small, are one reason national debt payments rose by 32% since last year. The need for the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low will further erode the dollar's purchasing power, subjecting more Americans to the insidious inflation tax. Yes. Therein lies the problem. This is why you have to have a wise and frugal government. Not just that. It's got to stay within a certain parameters. This is why in 1896 you had the National Democratic Party, the NDP, which, by the way, I talk about in my latest class at McClanahan Academy, American Conservatism. The NDP was a really interesting splinter party in 1896. They were the conservative Democrats, or the gold Democrats they were called, but they were there to protest essentially the leftward lurch of the Democrats under William Jennings Bryan in their mind. But they didn't want excessive spending. They wanted to ensure the dollar, you get 100 cents for every 100 cents work, you get 100 cents in pay, right? So it's not, you're not going to get a devalued or inflated dollar that doesn't mean anything. This is exactly what Ron Paul is talking about here. This, he says, will eventually cause a loss of the dollar's world reserve currency status. This will result in a major economic meltdown that will likely lead to widespread civil unrest, the further growth of authoritarian movements on both the left and the right, and new restrictions on liberty. All true. The one thing that will disrupt the United States is bankruptcy. Now, perhaps the United States could just say, we're done, we're not paying any of this. But then they're going to have to try to figure this out because nobody would lend any money to the United States. So everything has to be created in-house, and they're still going to have to cut spending at that point. They can't borrow anymore. They're going to have to print more. You see, it's a looming disaster. So what does Paul say? Well, the only way out of this is for Congress to begin winding down the welfare warfare state. A good place to start is by cutting spending on militarism and foregoing interventionism. Savings from these cuts could be used to ensure those dependent on entitlement and welfare programs are not harmed by as Congress winds down those programs. Responsibility for providing support for the truly needy should be returned to local and religious charitable institutions, while responsibility for education should be returned to local communities and parents. Congress should also pass legislation requiring any new spending to be offset by cuts in other federal spending and forbidding the Federal Reserve from purchasing federal debt instruments. These steps will be opposed by the special interests that benefit from the current system, but they are the only way to ensure the blessings of liberty and prosperity to our posterity, right? So, got to cut spending, got to cut it in the military, but he's saying at the end, he says, these steps will be opposed by the special interests that benefit from the current system. In other words, it's not going to happen. It's really pessimistic when you think about it. When you see, he says, well, parents have to take care of education, you're going to have a headwind there. Oh, no, no, no. We got poor communities. Can't pay. Their parents can't pay for anything. I mean, the states would be the proper vehicle to talk about education. Same thing with all of these other things. Federalism matters. This is the issue. But when the central government has centralized everything, then we're in a situation where, well, they control the purse strings on everything. They control what money the states get. The states are addicted to the cash drip, I mean, et cetera, et cetera. This is why Jefferson, again, in his first inaugural, said we have to rely on federalism. It has to be this balance between the federal and the state government. The states have to be maintained. It's the only way we're going to ensure that good government is followed in the United States. I mean, it's scary in a lot of ways. without question. We got Bloomberg saying they've run a million projections. Even Bloomberg says, in the end, it may take a crisis, perhaps a disorderly rout in the Treasury's market triggered by sovereign U.S. credit rating downgrades or a panic over the depletion of the Medicare or Social Security trust funds to force action. That's playing with fire. Ooh. Even Bloomberg says this. Last summer provided a foretaste in miniature of how a crisis might begin. Over 2 days in August, a Fitch Ratings downgraded the U.S. credit rating, and an increase of long-term Treasury debt issuance forced investor attention on the risks. Benchmark 10-year yields climbed by a percentage point, hitting 5% in October, the highest level in more than one and a half decades. As for how things might end, Britain's experience in the fall of 2022 provides a glimpse into the abyss. Then Prime Minister Liz Truss's plan for unfunded tax cuts sent the gilt markets into a tailspin. Yields soared so quickly that the central bank had to step in to snuff out the risk of an outright financial crisis. The bond vigilantes' actions forced the government to call off the plan and Truss out of office. For the U.S., the dollar's central role in international finance and status as the dominant reserve currency lowers the odds of a similar meltdown. It would take a lot to shake investor confidence in U.S. Treasury debt as the ultimate safe asset. If it did evaporate, though, the erosion of the dollar standing would be a watershed moment, with the U.S. losing not just access to cheap financing, but also global power and prestige. There is the problem. This is what Ron Paul's saying. It's going to take a major crisis for all this to shake out. This is dangerous. People are in the know. We need to go back to Jefferson. We need to start looking at federalism. We need to start thinking locally and acting locally. Do as much as you can to try to do those things, because this is a real danger. So, Paul doesn't think, they're going to have to lower interest rates, and that's going to come. Interest rates are going to come down. And what's that going to do? It will create inflation. And inflation, of course, is bad overall for the economy. It's bad for consumers in particular. But this is where, because your salary doesn't go up accordingly. Doesn't correspond with it. We don't get 3% salary increases every year if you're on a salary somewhere. This is why, even people now making $20 an hour, it's not what it used to be, right? So, I found both these pieces fascinating because they do relate back to Jefferson and the advice he gave in 1801 that we should still be following today if we just read Jefferson's inaugural address. If we did, maybe some of this stuff could be avoided. Anyways, thanks for joining me for this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show. Don't forget to get that American Conservatives class. You can use a coupon code to get it for $100 off. Now, that's the deal. I'm going to say this right at the end here. $100 off. It's only good for about a week. But $100 off the class, and I'm going to tell you the coupon because I forget what it is, but I'm pulling it up right now. If you use the coupon code conservative at checkout, you get the $100 off. So go to McClanahan Academy, use the coupon code conservative, get the class for $100 off. It's an awesome class. You're going to love it. $100 off, coupon code conservative. You help keep supporting this show. Don't forget the Patreon account and all the other things I've got. But you help keep supporting this show, and it's a win-win. You get great content too. All right. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.